Welcome back to the Reverse Alzheimer's Summit. I'm your host, Dr. Heather Sanderson, and so excited to introduce you to Dr. Nate Bergman. He's been passionate about proactive, preventive, and participatory medicine since his days as a research fellow at the NIH. He completed a fellowship in geriatric medicine at the Cleveland Clinic with emphasis on aging, the aging brain and body. Prior to his current position at Kemper Cognitive Wellness, he co-developed the Cleveland Clinic Center for Functional Medicine's Program for Cognitive Impairment. Nate remains curious about the incorporation of personalized data collection, computational tools, and other technological advances to assist clinicians at the bedside. Nate encourages his patients to deeply invest in their own health and wishes for each one to be the quarterback of their own movement towards greater health and wellness. When he's not in the office, he hosts and produces the Evolving Past Alzheimer's podcast and enjoys time with his wife and their five children. And I can just say, I tune in, I subscribe to the podcast and get tons of value from it. You stay really busy and also very on top of the latest research and what's going on in the Alzheimer's space. So thank you so much for taking some time to join us.
Oh, thanks for having us again.
So you're still seeing patients at Kemper Cognitive Wellness right now. And what are kind of the most critical pieces if someone comes to you with cognitive decline, if they're looking to improve, which I hope they are, if they show up in your office, what are some of the biggest pieces that work most consistently for the most people?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Yeah, for sure. We still see patients. I mean, we're always seeing patients. I help, you know, I think as soon as people as soon as a clinician stops seeing patients, that's when they have all the answers. You know, they don't have the humility of working with real human beings with real problems, right? It's all theoretical at that point. So we Kemper Cognitive Wellness in Cleveland, Rocky River, Ohio, which is in greater Cleveland, Ohio. In general, I call this kind of the summary of knowns. And this is I would say this is sort of an amalgam of peer review. And then I would say like observations from people like myself, people like yourself, you know, just working with, I have organized a fairly large group of clinicians at this point with like where we do online meetings and online conferences about, you know, like what's working for people. And so that's this is sort of a summary of some of those things, right? Many of those elements in general. Right. And we try to follow an evidence pyramid, starting with things that are most evidence-based and evidence-informed, and kind of working our way into things that are more esoteric and functional medicine and kind of alternative or integrative medicine space, as I know you've had other guests speak about. So I would say the first, and maybe the most important, but it's to act early, right? The earlier things are known, the earlier symptoms are attended to, typically the better and more spectacular the results, right? Like you get things cleaned up. But I would say in our experience, we meet a lot of people that are kind of further along. So people that are losing with Alzheimer's, that are losing their ability to stay independent, they may not be able to drive, they might not be able to remember to take medications, and certainly, you know, further on down, all the way till needing nursing home placement or hospice in some cases. And so I think most importantly, engagement, so purpose, right? When it comes to these kinds of programs that so many of us are working with, functional medicine principles, lifestyle principles to start, it really requires from a patient or, you know, a family that's coming to see us, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? What is their purpose? And sometimes I would say one of the things that we've learned really probably in the last year and a half, even since the last time we talked, you and I have talked together, is like it is possible through the same kind of paradigm as iterative change happens. It's possible to take people from a lack of sense of belief that they can do anything about this to that they can. And then sometimes that infuses purpose, right? So for example, we're working with a woman that we started working with last summer around July, 2021. When we saw her, she was just getting a diagnosis of a neurodegenerative disease. It wasn't Alzheimer's, but it was kind of similar. And she worked with us for 6 months, and then she joined a program that we have called Brain Fit, which is, you know, a couple hours of different kinds of mental and physical exercise and some technologies and things. And she's worked really steadily. And when we started with her last summer, we said, hey, let's call her Mary. We said, hey, Mary, what's your goal. And she didn't really have a goal. She was living alone, still fairly young, right? Still fairly young. And but was really kind of scared. Her daughters were scared. She'd lose independence. But we have, you have to like have, what is it that someone is doing this work for? Right? Like, obviously. And, you know, some people show up to work because they need a paycheck. For this group of people, I don't have to tell you, but you know, for our listeners and people that are watching this, it's like, if someone doesn't have a reason, and it may be inherent, I want to always get better. I want to have, you know, I have better brain function, but why? And getting into that, we're spending more and more time kind of digging into that, because that is one of, I would say, one of the secret ingredients or secret sauces and of getting people kind of activated, moving. And over time, the more that we kind of work with this, it seems that, I think the thing that's surprising is that sometimes people will surprise us, people that don't really have a clear purpose. Like Mary, we said, hey, she wants to go on a trip to Europe, to Germany. That was really her goal. And in 4 weeks, she's headed out, right? She's improved. Her cognitive scores have improved remarkably. Her physical self, her ability to feel confident, independent, has changed significantly. And the scores that we measure on her improved. So it's like, those are the kinds of things that the more she kind of sunk in and said, I want to do this. I want to get up for this. So she's going with a group of friends to Europe, Germany amongst them. And, those are exciting things. Those are the things we're in it for. So that, I'd say that's the first thing in terms of what we think we know. Another one seems to be that for many people, but not all, and that's an interesting maybe side conversation, like a key sort of rescuing brain energy with some trend or period of time in ketosis or a ketogenic diet, whether it's nutritional ketosis or people are using some kind of powder or pill or liquid outside of just regular food, kind of supplements or exogenous ketones, to get people into ketosis to sort of rescue brain energy. Interesting, we've had, and I'm curious to hear what other people are seeing as well. We've had some kind of quick results with those for some people, especially if they're coming from a place of maybe a suboptimal diet, the standard American diet for sure. But even sometimes people that are kind of eating vegan or, kind of a high vegetable, low protein, lower fat diet, you can get some pretty quick results. I'm believing right now that the mechanism might be probably neuroinflammation. Can't say for sure, kind of depends on the choices of the ketogenic diet, but it's pretty interesting, like, to see people like getting results in like 2 to 4 weeks where they're really kind of noticing a difference with cognition. So that's, to some people, it's kind of old news. I think what's interesting is to see then how long do you continue that out? Do you drop people into ketosis every once in a while? Like we're working with one guy who had a nice result in his 80s, diagnosed with the pre-Alzheimer's and now sort of has shifted into an Alzheimer's diagnosis, classic, short-term memory loss. And, the parts of his brain on his brain scans are small. They're sort of classic for, traditional Alzheimer's disease. And did a period of ketogenic diet, flipped out of it. Now is kind of shifting back into it. So, it's like a long-term, lifelong commitment, ketogenic diet. So it's interesting to see people sort of pop in, pop out. And then sometimes people lose track of that. It's easy to lose track of because it's a hard thing. Anybody's tried a ketogenic diet, it's a hard thing to sustain. That you can get kind of a fast result, and that's really neat. Exercising with intensity, so that really is a sweet spot. Every once in a while, it seems like it's every couple of years, British Medical Journal, then there was another one this, I don't know if it was the end of 2021, beginning of 2022, there'll be an article saying that like too much intensity of exercise does not seem to help people or makes people with dementia worse, particularly Alzheimer's dementia. But some of these, the British Medical Journal, I don't know, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, wasn't specific as to what kind of, is this like all-cause dementia? It's hard to know. So it does seem, though, that a couple days a week of something that's more intense than someone's usual, so getting heart rate up, working muscles a little bit harder, and that's going to look different for everyone, obviously. That's a recipe for success. But it is also possible, just with Alzheimer's, just like sort of everything else, to kind of overtrain, to overtrain. And so that's just one of those ones that just for someone who's kind of further along on that Alzheimer's journey, maybe they have a later, you know, they're in mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's kind, or sort of a true Alzheimer's dementia where they've already maybe lost some ability to be independent. Figuring out how much, you know, and how intense, it's easy to say, hey, exercise with intensity nearly every day. I don't think that's going to be, that's not the sweet spot for every single person, right? There are other aspects and other areas of the body and brain that need to be trained. And I think you had a couple of people talk about that as well on the summit. Next one's obvious, but needs to be attended to because it's kind of rising up, one, you know, so 1A and 1B in terms of evidence within Alzheimer's disease is fixing sleep issues, right? And that might be starting with something like insomnia or sleep apnea. And so we're super aggressive looking for those issues, treating those issues. Sleep cycles, sleep sort of circadian rhythm disorders are common in the population. And that's, of course, still a kind of a chicken and egg question. Is it Alzheimer's that causes the circadian rhythm disruption, or is it circadian rhythm dysfunction that portends Alzheimer's? I think the truth is probably going to be somewhere in between, that there's the anti-symbiotic relationship between the two of them. So pushing really hard, because sometimes when you fix sleep just by itself, there's a pickup in cognition, just as a sort of a mono intervention, or that's the only thing people do. Dental issues, which I know you're talking about as well. Dental issues and sort of inflammation in the mouth, periodontal disease is another thing that makes a big difference. And then I think everything else, you know, technologies, hormones, detoxification, infections, things like that, immune system function, all of those things are sort of, I would say, secondary to the big ones. The one I'm most curious about with the kind of least data, and I don't know if you have any good speakers or new notes yourself on this one, is sort of the toxin bucket, because that's one that's hard. All these things are hard to quantify. They're functional medicines, not rabbit holes, but there's definitely big time links that are accepted, you know, all the way through American Academy of Neurology. Just no one knows how to measure these things in a consistent way. And no one really truly knows, in my opinion, at least, what to do about them. I think we have, all of us have sort of strategies about what we think is probably the best thing. But I don't know if you've ever seen, I've seen a couple of cases where people got worse cognitively with detoxification. So it's one of those, like, proceed with caution, or at least be working with someone who has some experience taking this journey with other people that have the same kind of diagnosis. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great rundown. Very efficient. I feel like that should be the required reading for the required listening for everybody starting off this summit, because that was a great just like snapshot into everything that we are discussing this week. So thank you. Let's get into one of the other big pieces, the skepticism around the term reversal with dementia. So when I think of it, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean cure. There are people with severe dementia who will never go back to work. However, I have also seen miracles happen where we see people with severe disease get a little bit better and then improves their quality of life. I've also seen people with, like you mentioned earlier on in the severity of the disease and the progression of the disease, and they tend to be younger in their 50s and 60s. And in 6 months, I mean, they have no more cognitive issues. It can be miraculous and really worthwhile. And yet there are also people who still say there's no such thing as reversal. And we certainly have people sign up who do not get better and some that get worse, right? Continue to progress and get worse. And so there's a mixed bag of responses. Where do you perceive the skepticism around the word reversal and Alzheimer's comes from?
Yeah, I mean, so I have my vantage point was kind of formed and fashioned in iron sharpens iron kind of an environment, like at the Cleveland Clinic. And there you couldn't just make a claim. You had to come with some kind of graded evidence. And that's, you know, I think that's a good thing in general for all of us human beings, but we become patients. But I think it's a good thing for the kind of the patient community, because there are a lot of people out there that will that seem to be able to claim a lot of kinds of evidence. And even people, you know, it was 5-6 years ago, were co-opting somebody like Dale Bredesen's work, who had written a paper in 2014, Reversal of Cognitive Decline. That was sort of what started him and started a lot of us. And certainly for me, that was really what made me pay attention to, wow, we can take a very kind of precise dive into a lot of things, a lot of areas that kind of drive Alzheimer's disease. And that was early on. I mean, it was like a medical hypothesis paper where he had 10 people that improved, right? Basically following these principles. And shortly thereafter, you're getting emails from people saying, did you know that Dr. Dale Bredesen has proven that you can reverse Alzheimer's? It was just like one of these, like things got carried away too quickly. And so what happens in a place like Cleveland Clinic, and I've talked to, call them serious scientists all over the country and some around the world. And it brings sort of like undue or unnecessary skepticism to this sort of approach that it's being talked about in this summit, where there's so much good. And if there's just sort of more of an honesty or a transparency about the kinds of results people are seeing and what it takes to be a patient and all that kind of thing, I think we'd have less criticism. In the meantime, not the Cleveland Clinic, not Mayo Clinic, not Johns Hopkins, none of those on their commercials lead with the failures, right? None of them lead with the failures. And you can read Marty McCarry's, you can read plenty of people that have worked in these kinds of environments. We'll talk about, the realities of the hospital itself. But I think mostly the issue is in terms of being honest and transparent about our outcomes, and then being honest and transparent about the kinds of approaches that we're using, as opposed to being sort of ashamed or of them. I think a lot of people don't, I don't know how exactly to look for toxins, or what's the story with mold or Lyme's disease. And I think it's fair to say we're not sure. And I think from an academic standpoint, if you're like, Lyme's, there's no connection. I've had so many, I'm sure you have had too, of people will go to their neurologist at these famous places, famous institutions, and they'll be like, mold has nothing to do with Alzheimer's, or, and then 5, 6, 10 years ago, 5, 6, 10 years later, it's like, oh, really, it did. But by that time, the patient who I'm seeing and you're seeing now might be long gone, right? Because the academician didn't have time, didn't have the interest, wasn't as sort of as far down the rabbit hole with some of the kinds of interventions we're talking about. So I think transparency and choice for patients, and then us being diligent about how we collect data and the kinds of research we're involved in, all of those things are important. But in the meantime, like, people are sick and people need help, and we need to help them, and it's sort of all hands on deck. So being transparent, and then just spending the time to develop relationships with academic centers and skeptics. And I put myself in that sort of skeptic camp. Because at this point, I think 3-4 years ago, people didn't even give the metabolic approach, lifestyle, exercise, diet, sleep. They wouldn't admit that had anything to do with an improvement in cognition. I mean, we're not even talking about long ago. We're talking about like 2018. That was still like a controversy. 2019. And now it seems like, Alzheimer's Association, everybody's kind of talking about brain health and I'm definitely following this for a good 10 years, this area. And, it's not forever, but it's, pretty closely for about 10 years. And it's really interesting to see the shift in the last, four years or so. So if that's the case, then why wouldn't other things that we're talking about that are coming down the kind of the pipeline, and maybe there's some truth to that. So I think we need to kind of parlay some of the success in the metabolic approaches that are now pretty widely accepted, and Ivy League programs, famous academic programs are starting these kind of metabolic diseases approaches for Alzheimer's, and then Alzheimer's precursors, anxiety, depression, bipolar, sort of all like mood disorders, like it's a big novel thing. Even though you and I, kind of learned about these things in our training and have been practicing them for a decade or more.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm putting you on the spot here because we didn't talk about this before, but have you heard of this book, or have you read How Not to Study a Disease, The Alzheimer's Story, Carl Haroop?
I never. Can I see it?
Yeah, I don't know if you've got your hands on this yet.
No, I gotta read that one.
It's a good one. It might just be because we're Alzheimer's nerds, but I mean, I read it cover to cover on one plane flight because it was really fascinating. It's an engaging story. Lots of detail about, he's a researcher, a lab researcher in the dementia space. And he just talks about kind of how we came to this being stuck in this dead end rut of the beta amyloid plaque hypothesis. Yeah. With so much effort and time and ungodly amounts of money being thrown at this disease that we all realize is, you know, radically shifting right now with the demographics and really a huge detriment to society if we continue down this path. And yet we've gotten stuck in this, barking up the wrong tree, basically. And so how to get out of that, how to unwind some of these bad decisions that basically got made along the way, where we kept doubling down on this one hypothesis when really it looks like it's a multifactorial disease. So I think everyone probably agrees, right? Beta amyloid plaques and tau proteins have something to do with dementia, but how much do they have to do with Alzheimer's dementia? And what else needs to kind of get brought to the table when we have these conversations? So I'm curious your thoughts about medications coming down the pipeline, about these hypotheses and kind of how you make sense of it all.
Yeah. So I think in general, the more I read about, I'm happy to work in a hospital system. Like they're good. They're generally speaking good places, but they're businesses, right? And so I think when critics attack a naturopathic doctor or a MD who's in private practice, who's practicing in a cash-based practice because they cannot keep their doors open if they took insurance, because you simply can't see 5-6 people a day and make it in an insurance-based practice, unless you're selling something else. And people levy criticism against the cash approach when they themselves work for an institution that, as a physician, they've completely outsourced. You know, this wasn't the case 25 years ago. Most physicians 30 years ago, even, you know, basically since the late 1990s, prior to the late 1990s, were owning their own practice. There were a lot of people getting very wealthy, just doing kind of usual care. And now most physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, maybe in the West Coast, maybe even naturopaths are sort of working in a healthcare system. So they've outsourced all of the billing, all of the costing. And I know if you go to a place here in Cleveland and you don't pay your bill, first of all, you're not getting in the door without insurance, or you're not getting a test unless it's been there's been a prior authorization. And then even if you're 2 weeks late on a payment, they're going to collections. So nobody's doing this for free. It's just, I think that there's this partition or separation between the individual who's the customer, the patient, me as a patient, the physician in an insurance-based model, and then the sort of third party payer. So this idea that everybody that's sort of not charging is doing the right thing, I think is completely, it's an ignorant perspective, right? It's a misinformed perspective, because they're just not aware that all of this stuff is happening sort of the same way on the backside. So with that sort of like skepticism about medicine and the medical community, right? Like at the same time, knowing that there's extraordinary people and extraordinary scientists, and extraordinary individuals like in these fields, we take, okay, what are the medications that are coming down the pipeline for Alzheimer's, right? As of this recording, like when we were, I think last year when we were talking about this, aducanumab or Aduhelm had just been approved. And then recently, Medicare decided they're not paying for it except within the context of a trial, because, you know, all of the reasons it'll bankrupt Medicare. I mean, all of the reasons, how much did it help already? It just didn't help that much. It seems to slow things down a little bit, which if you're early stage sounds pretty good. You know, if you're trying to make it 5 more years till your last child gets married or something like that, maybe that's a good, maybe that's a reasonable approach. But the idea that that's what's true and all these other things are not, because they haven't been sufficiently studied because nobody wants to do the study, that's not fair, right? But the medications coming down the pipeline, things that are sort of aducanumab or Aduhelm-like, like lecanemab, like they call it BAN2401, or donanemab, like there are other medications that are in the same class as those as the one that got the original approval in 2021. Like they say they're going to work better. They, you know, people that I've talked to that are in these clinical trials seem to feel like, you know, these are they're an improvement over the original one. So I do think that we'll have like this kind of chemotherapeutic approach to Alzheimer's. But it goes back to what you said before, Heather. I think that still fails to recognize, and I'm interested in that book, it still fails to recognize that there's not like one mechanism for Alzheimer's. So yeah, you could put the stop and start to eliminate some of these amyloid beta, but A, why is it happening to begin with? And B, what are all the other kind of elements? And just like I could definitely envision a day where like everybody's on an Alzheimer's medicine, sort of like everybody's on statins. You know, like if you have a high amyloid, you get the blood test, and if you have an amyloid above this, and you have this risk, and you're above this age, you'll be on an amyloid medication. And it probably won't be in the days of IVs, but it'll probably be when they have an oral pill for something like that, and you'll be on a combination. But that's, to me, talking to the sort of the amyloid guys that in the field, they're like, well, if you don't think amyloid has anything to do with Alzheimer's, then you don't understand Alzheimer's. Right, sort of like saying, if you don't think atherosclerosis, or you know, the plaque that builds up in most people's arteries with heart disease, doesn't have to do with heart disease, then you don't know what heart disease is. So that's a fair statement, but it's a little myopic.
There's also a lot of data that suggests that that's not a fair statement, right? Because less than 1% of the population, and the entire population on the planet, no matter how old you are, has no beta amyloid plaque in their brain, wow, right? So like everyone has some beta amyloid plaque. And over 65, so elderly people on the planet, people over 65, seniors on the planet, 30% of them, regardless of their cognitive capacity, have enough beta amyloid to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. You have people with perfect cognitive function who have plenty of plaques and, you know, plenty of plaques and tangles in their brains when they die. And so, yes, there's a connection, but it's not predictive of cognitive function.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes it's predictive of cognitive function, but like you're saying, like it's such a myopic point. It comes back to, well, we did it. We have the answer. Come to the hospital for your answer. We can fix you. And it reduces the idea of Alzheimer's. And it's hard to even get a clear consensus around what Alzheimer's is, because a lot of people that have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's probably, or they may not have Alzheimer's, or they probably have, I'm more convinced of, probably people have a lot of mixed type dementias, whether it's late or it's a little bit of Lewy body, you know, sort of a Parkinson's kind of a thing, vascular. I do think though, we're pretty close, and we're getting to that point where we're gonna have drugs that are approved for Alzheimer's. And then, you know, then for sure they'll have all the answers. Like now, once we have an approved drug, then all the other sort of approaches, that means that none of them are true, right? And I'm just joking, I'm saying that facetiously. But I look forward to the time where we can combine medications with the kinds of approaches you and I are talking about today.
I absolutely do as well. I think that there's a great complement potential there, right? If we can get rid of the why are these plaques and tangles being formed? Why is there inflammation in the brain? What does the brain feel like it needs to protect itself from? Then we can do that first or at the same time, and then get rid of the plaques and tangles. They're like scar tissue, right? There's been some damage done, and we want to get rid of that. Of course, we want full healing. Yet if we don't get rid of the reason why they formed in the first place, we're not going to get an improvement in cognitive function, which is the whole point of these conversations, right? Is making sure that that person has a better quality of life, better experience, better cognitive function, not the amount of amyloid in their brain.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, like if it's again, just to add more fuel to the point you're making, if you took most Americans 40 and up off the street, just did x-rays on their back, their knees, 9 out of 10 are going to have arthritis findings, but they might not have arthritis. Same thing you take with the neck or heart. Like a lot of people have buildup, it's just not going to be symptomatic. So for sure, yeah, the point about amyloid and just like taking amyloid out, points well taken, but you know, Biogen's on it. So there's a lot of people that are really invested in simple models.
Right, right. Well, let's go back to our more complex model, because just because it's challenging or complicated doesn't mean it's not worthwhile, right? What does a kind of like a rehabilitation process, if you will, look like for somebody who's already suffering with some cognitive decline?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, if it's probably been well laid out by other guests, other speakers, Dale Bredesen, Dr. Perlmutter. I mean, there's plenty of people that are that have the answers to that. That, you know, I'd just be repeating what they said. But I think what's kind of new and interesting today, don't hear us talked about as much, is this for people that already have dementia, right? So for people that already have dementia, meaning they have cognitive loss and they've lost the ability to be independent, completely independent on their own. There's a lot to be done, right? We were calling it, live well with dementia, living well with dementia. And it's an interesting process right now. So the whole field of cognitive reablement is, how much skill can we get back? How much gain can we get back, even in someone who is at a real deficit and a real loss, who has some sort of a catastrophic or a huge amount of cognitive loss. And I think an ideal approach is going to include some of the mental and physical exercises. But I mean, what we're doing, what we are, we're really specifically teaching people, we're doing exercises that will improve verbal memory, visual memory, processing speed, even the ability to attend, to pay attention, which can improve memory, it can improve executive function. All of these are inputs. So like if you're training cognitive skills, cognitive domains, we'll often see the general trajectory of people's, let's say just their scores or how they're doing in life, or when you ask a care partner how they're doing, they'll be doing the same, if not better, right? So it's it's one thing to see someone who's mild, like my first patient tomorrow, somebody you mentioned, like the kind of person you mentioned, late 50s, early 60s, mom passed away with dementia in long-term care. She started having real sort of concerning symptoms, started on the program, snaps back, gets back, she's just back to herself. And I mean, those are extraordinary. Those are exciting. But it's also extraordinary exciting in some cases, kind of almost more so, because it's not supposed to happen. Even more, where someone is, like you mentioned, very, very symptomatic and much further along, and they start to have a stabilization of decline. And then they start to have, maybe some days are better, or there are aspects of their life that are improving, that are clearer. They're more able to articulate what they're doing. They're better with math. They can calculate a tip, just like wild stuff. We can just see the brain, like, sort of higher cortical functions, like sort of higher cognitive abilities, start to sort of like come back online. Even if it's not all the time, it's just enormously exciting. So I think, really being specific about that cultivation of purpose and spirit, cultivation on why someone would challenge themselves like this, and doing the right kinds of mental and physical exercises, and then complementing that with diet and supplements and sort of all the other things that we'll do, sort of sprinkling in some technology that can accelerate the process here. It's the most exciting. Among the most exciting things that I'm involved with on a kind of a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, just hearing you kind of explain that you're seeing similar things, because sometimes I sit here in my office, in Southern California, going, gosh, like, how am I the only one doing this? How, like, this must be happening in other places. And just to hear that the same stuff is happening in Cleveland, it's like my heart is just so full, because it means that we're not, we're not mistaking what we're doing. Like, this is real. And it just adds more credibility to it, and it definitely gives me more hope. And I think just letting everyone know, that, yes, of course we need more science. We always need more science. We always need more data, and it's coming. We finished our 25 participant trial. We're going to publish that soon. I wish that it was ready to go out right now and I could talk about it all day long right now, but alas, I have to wait. But I'm really excited to get that data out there. And then we are going to do a follow-up trial. Dr. Bredesen is working on a follow-up trial to his first 25-participant trial. They're going to do a 100-participant trial. So this is all happening. And the context of that is like, why did it take so long, right? Well, for a long time, if you weren't studying amyloid, you weren't studying Alzheimer's, right? So everything was going in that direction. And then also what we are doing is multifactorial. And so getting an IRB or an internal review board to approve that, there's been funding for quite a while through philanthropy. A lot of people have realized that this was worth looking into, and there were people willing to fund it, but there weren't IRBs willing to approve it. And to do human research trials, you have to have an IRB that'll get behind you. And so now, just in the past 5 years, and maybe in the past 4 to 5 years, that's why we're seeing so much shift. So we're more focused when we look at this hierarchy of research, we're starting to shift our focus towards more patient-centered outcomes. And that means including trials that have multiple interventions at the same time, right? This idea is that if you stack things like you've been discussing, detox and diet and sleep and, you know, all, and exercise, of course, if you start putting all these things together, then you would expect to get even better outcomes than if you just do one. There's this spiraling up, or virtuous cycle that you get out of stacking these interventions. And so, I think that is one of the most exciting things happening right now in this space. I'm curious, what else, what other exciting trends you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to sort of round out the conversation with. Honestly, the most exciting thing to me right now is the sort of stabilizations that we see with people that already have a diagnosis that are willing to put in some work. That's really cool. You know, we're trying to keep people independent and keep them out of a long-term care, nursing home, whatever you want to call it, is exciting. It really requires people to put in the work. And I think we're seeing more people, we're seeing definitely a fair number of people that are kind of willing to put in the work. They kind of understand, okay, if I want a different option, then I'm just going to go to a hospital and get an injection once a month, which would be great. You know, like everybody wants sort of a simple option. That's number one. I see people stabilizing through the right kind of therapy, right? The right therapeutics. Another thing that we see sort of a signal of, I can tell you, one impressive story that we had recently, this whole kind of field of electroceuticals, right? So that electroceuticals could mean anything from sort of like a neurosurgeon opening up someone's brain, putting an implantable device for, let's say, a deep brain stimulator for something like commonly approved for a Parkinson's tremor that will reduce the severity of a tremor. But there have been devices that have deep brain stimulators that have been big trial failures, you know, big industry sponsored trial failures so far for deep brain stimulation in Alzheimer's disease. But non-invasive brain stimulation with transcranial electrics, light therapies, does have some promise. And these are, they're tricky. It's a tricky study. They're tricky studies. And they're mostly small and short. But I've talked to three really serious neuroscience researchers. Just talked to a really interesting guy, University of California, San Francisco. Although he works apparently in Emory, works full-time like remote, and he's a full professor at UCSF. But another brilliant guy, mid-career, Ted Santo is his name. And we were just kind of comparing notes, like he's interested in direct current stimulation, alternating current stimulation, all sort of other, you know, a number of other things. And I would say where we're adding entrainment or small amounts of either light or electricity to the brain. So just to make this real for people, so we had a woman in her late 70s, let's call her D. So we saw D, she's late 70s, she got a gene for Alzheimer's, she had an APOE4 copy, dementia runs in her family, she had PTSD, pretty significant. Anxiousness, probably, you know, would have been called, you know, ADHD now. She was taking stimulants in the 1970s for it. And anyways, we see her and she's trying to live alone. Her son's trying to do the best by her to get her in home care, but she's belligerent and angry with the care staff in her house, and they keep trying to, they keep losing people. And she won't get up, she won't exercise, she won't participate in physical therapy. She needs a knee replacement, but they don't want to do the knee replacement because she won't do physical therapy, and she gets the surgery and doesn't do PT, then she's going to end up in a chair her whole life, right? The rest of her life. And so we started off with her, and, you know, we try to get her to do many, many things, you know, all the stuff. She was not having it. This is like a tough Italian lady. She's not having it. And, but she, you know, she was a good sport about things. Like but she didn't always remember. She was, just to give you a sense, Heather, her MoCA score, her Montreal Cognitive Assessment score, was 13 with a lot of loss. So that's a fairly low, fairly advanced. She could still have a pleasant conversation with you, kind of know who you are. And that was no issue, but she wouldn't engage, just wouldn't get out of bed, couldn't get dressed. And in the course of, in a month, so we put her, this is one of those ones we saw kind of an immediate impact. She had recently been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So she went on ketogenic diet, got off, I think she was just on metformin, got off all her other diabetes medicines really pretty quickly. And started, you know, sort of clearing things up. I started another prescription medication on her to sort of calm down excitation in her brain. And then we brought her in that was the only thing we could get her to do, those two things. And then we did get her in to come into the office several times a week for these stimulations. We used alternating current stimulation with her. We used some noise frequency, pink noise. But we tried a few things until we found, you know, the network that we kind of needed to light up with her, the area of the network we need to light up with her. And her MoCA in a month, so again, normal score would be 26 or above technically. Hers was 13 to start. In 1 month, she went from 13 to 20. The scores are interesting, but like, it's just somebody like you and I, but it's more about like what her life was like, getting up out of bed, ready for a care partner in the morning, eating, participating in cognitive exercises, willing and able to let, you know, the physical therapist into her house. So like her brain was organizing, and her, it's funny, her care partner was, you know, like, you know, not a clinical person, and she was more commenting on her mood, right? Her mood seemed so much better. She just seemed so much more agreeable as her brain started to organize more, right? And so, you know, you get rid of some of that inflammation, and you start to, you know, let the dust clear with all the blood sugar stuff. And then you add some, hey, this is sort of the rhythm and frequency that the brain needs.
Yeah, let's be real. I'm more agreeable when I'm in ketosis.
Well, I don't know. Not everybody says that. I mean, some people, especially some, you know, some premenopausal women I've seen that have had a really rough time with a full ketogenic diet. But in general, like, I think most people feel like a cleaner burn. So technologies are interesting. They're hard because, you know, people have to, in most cases, they have to kind of come into the office. Well, there's some things, you know, like be light, and there's some things that people can do at home. The other thing that I've heard this from really some very credible sources. Do you know who Robin Carhart-Harris is?
No.
Robin Carhart-Harris is kind of one of the leading names in psychedelic research. Oh. Right? He's kind of a hardcore neuroscientist, and, you know, doing a lot of fMRI studies. He was in England for a long time. University of California in San Francisco just poached him. They got him. So rumor has it that they may be using some of whether it's psilocybin, I'm not sure yet, but there's talk from some of the people in that neuroscape division that they may be starting to use psychedelics in hopes of sort of sparking things from a neuroplasticity or neurodegenerative, so a neuroregenerative a point. To me, it's still kind of speculation, and I want to wait until kind of the craziness of every psychedelics can cure everything, you know. For instance, somebody sent me an article from Harvard where they were touting how exciting the psychedelics are, and how it seemed like one of those articles where we're going to solve everything with psychedelics. which I hope we do.
Maybe. I know. I would love it. That sounds like a lot of fun.
I'm more than 85% certain that we won't, but I hope that we do. I hope that none of us ever have to work again, and we live in world harmony and world peace, you know, and for eternity with psychedelics. But preparing for the possibility that that's not the case, I read this article, and it was like, this was like, hey, see, these things work. They had this was for depression, so it wasn't for Alzheimer's, but it just, you know, sort of speaks to the unknowns in this sort of world of psychedelics. So 30% of the people that with refractory depression, so bad, you know, bad depression that wasn't getting better with other kind of traditional medicines, improved with psychedelics versus less than 10% with control. That's 30%. I mean, that's not 80%. It's not 60%. It was like 30% of people. So, and I'm sure you've seen people that have kind of the opposite effect, right? So I think that it's always going to sort of boil down to, are you treating the whole human being? Are you treating the whole human being? And does this human being that you're treating, do they want whole human being treatment, right? Or they just give me the pill, give me, I'll go in for the injection. I mean, those options seem to that they will always be available, but the kind of the whole human approach, it does seem like, at least in some pockets, more than what was 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, especially in Alzheimer's, there seems to be like a ray of sunshine of hope that maybe there's more openness to this, than had been before. Yeah. And then I think the other thing that's really kind of exciting is, you know, as unfortunately more younger people end up with Alzheimer's, like the 35 to 64 population, as we know, is growing with in diagnosis. Is it because of pollution? I don't know. But, you know, there's certainly all kinds of theories like that. But it's because of mitochondria disrepair. Is it because of, I'm not sure. Because there are more younger people with this disease, it's as opposed to it's grandma and she's in the nursing home. And, you know, like there's this picture of like Alzheimer's of someone just like in a nursing home with their tongue out. They don't recognize their spouse or they don't recognize their child, which is certainly, you know, certainly still happens. But because there's been more younger people, there's like just more people that are just saying, hey, we're not going to take this line down. We're going to fight. We're going to do something about this. They're getting organized. Reminds me a little bit of like the Lyme community, you know, like sort of people that are going to take the chronic fatigue syndrome sort of people that are going to like take matters into their own hand. And that's exciting because, you know, so many times we felt like, oh, we have an answer. I'm going to build build the thing and take it. And people, and I know what people need. And again, I don't probably have to tell you the number of times where we thought we had the answer that we took it and people that are closer to the problem and give us feedback on it as to how to make it better has really been that's been a godsend. So even just an organization like DAI, Dementia Alliance International, these are like really cool patient or human beings with the disease led organizations. And like while it's still agonizing to see people with these diagnoses, struggling with these diagnoses, the inspiration from the struggle, from watching the struggle is extraordinary. And then I think there's also room, I think finally, just to round it, I think there's also more and more room. I know I'm starting to sort of trying to figure out ways to naturally include this in the practice. And I've been sort of shy to do it for a while, although it's part of kind of the functional medicine matrix and model. Is to talk more about spirit and spirituality in the context of these visits, because sometimes that's, you know, it depends on someone's, obviously it depends on people's backgrounds and what their sensitivities are, and you know, do they come from a sort of a Christian Catholic background? Do they come from another background? But like drawing on whatever people have, or using the experience of, you know, this sort of harrowing experience, usually if it's for a care partner, of like losing like a spouse to this, can be a big opening and obviously a big opportunity for a certain kind of growth. So incorporating that in there, like it just sort of blows the whole thing up a little bit, and then we can start to focus on what you were talking about before of like choice, and you know, what are we what are we really doing with this, and how much are we helping? And you know, some people call the sort of a patient-centered, sort of a patient-centered approach, an individual or a family-centered approach, for well, you know, what are all the tools that we have, and you know, here's what we have. Let me help you with all of these many, many tools, as opposed to just like the one medication. So exciting times. It's a very exciting time to be in the space. There's just blowing up all over the place, and I appreciate for you for being sort of a one of the mouthpieces for this kind of work.
Yeah, I feel so grateful and privileged to, you know, be working on this project with you of changing the narrative, right? This isn't going to be for everyone. This approach isn't feasible for everyone, right? And especially right now, it costs money. You have to have resources. You have to have time. And yet, everyone should still know that this is an option, right? No one should be told there's nothing you can do, because it's almost overwhelming how much is possible to do. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody has to pick it up and run with it and do all of it. But for someone to be told that there's nothing when there's all of this potential, I think it's just, I mean, it's inhumane. It shouldn't be legal, right? Yet it's just the refrain from neurology. And so thank you for doing this work with me of changing the story around what's possible for those suffering. I couldn't agree more that the passion and energy and inspiration that comes from all of us who want to reduce suffering in the world, right? And those who are in the throes of either caring for someone with dementia or who have it, who are suffering themselves, that, you know, there's nothing more amazing than watching a human transform that tragedy into just helping and hope and hope for other people. And so I love that you kind of mentioned that watching these organizations form where people are just like, I'm not going to give up, and are looking for solutions. And certainly we're looking to partner with them. Nate, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you are busy, and your kids, your family is waiting to have dinner with you. So I'm going to let you go.
Hear them screaming? I don't think I put the screaming back.
No, I can't hear them screaming, but go join in the fun. Let's not wait so long to connect again. It's always a pleasure. I learned so much from you. And like I said, it's just so heartwarming to hear that you have similar stories to ours happening across the country. It means that it should be happening in every city in the country. And certainly we'll continue to work towards that. Make sure, one more time, tell everyone where they can find out more about you.
Yeah, so we're at Kemper Cognitive Wellness. If you just go to kemperwellness.com and you'll find
us. K-E-M-P-R.
Yeah, K-E-M-P-R, kemperwellness.com. And we're there. We'd love to meet you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Nate.
Thanks again for doing this, though.